Our first story today is about an unexpected inheritance and how it changed one couple's life forever. Here's Sketches producer Maya Bosworth.
Nigel Durkin and Julian Bovis live in a village called Uppermill in Saddleworth.
So we're right on the edge of the moors and about 12 miles east of Manchester.
That's Nigel. He spent his career as an art therapist. And this is Julian.
I guess it was a cotton town back in the 18th century, 19th century.
He studied architecture and worked as an art director on Fleet Street for many years. And he's now an artist.
And it still looks pretty much the same. There's not a lot of modern development here. So it still looks just old stone houses. And beyond that are the beautiful, vivid green hills, which turn purple in the autumn.
We'd come for a walk. And there was a for sale sign going up on the building. And we looked up and it's a three-storey Georgian terrace. The stones are black from all the soot from all the mills, and they were used as loom shops for weaving wool.
Most of my life I've planned out within an inch of its life, really. I've always known where I'm going to be moving and what I'm going to be doing. It's the first place that I've ended up by accident, really.
Julian and I fled London at separate times, but in the same year and same month. He moved to Salford and I moved to Manchester. And we met on Grindr. I don't know if we can say that on Radio 4, but I think we were one of the first marriages of Grindr. I don't know. And it's that stupid thing that people always say, you know when you know, but we knew.
You know, within months, we'd gone from two single men living in different parts of Manchester to a couple living in a big old Georgian house on the moors. And it felt like we'd fast-tracked things. It felt like we'd been together 10 years within a year. And that was us, and then we were here, and then we met Joan.
Joan was 80-year-old Joan Charnley, their new next-door neighbour.
The person we were buying the house from took us for a little walk through the village, and we met her on a corner, and he introduced us to her, and she was grumpy and had a bag of cakes and wasn't particularly friendly. And I thought, oh, it's typical. You know, we find this lovely house moving, and we've got someone miserable next door.
And it took about 6 months for us to be invited in for a cup of tea. But within minutes of being in her kitchen, and she was in entertaining mode, she was a dream. You know, she was gregarious, funny, and open. She was really open, I felt.
Little by little, they found out more about Joan's amazing life. She was born in 1928 and she had studied textile design and taken part in the Festival of Britain. She'd showed her designs to Liberties and Heels, but she was told they were too advanced and that they'd never sell. She taught textile design for many years and she'd lived on the street since the early 60s with her late husband, the Scottish artist Archie MacDonald, who died in 1991.
And then it was strange. Again, it was a bit like Nigel and I's relationship. It went in fast forward, and then suddenly we were best friends within weeks.
Joan had a studio on the top floor of her house where she worked on her textile designs and botanical drawings. Soon, Julian and Nigel were coming round every afternoon. Nigel and Joan bonded over gardening, cooking, a love of history, and she and Julian bonded over their art.
There's the old romantic thing, isn't there, about having a nice, kindly, old, wise grandmother. And I'd never had that, and she hadn't had the son. So we had this instant formulaic relationship. But it was based on love and respect, really. I thought she was amazing. I absolutely adored playing Scud with Joan. It brought out a competitive side in her, which I have the same. But she was incredibly competitive, and she was a terrible cheat. It turns out she'd spent years cheating all her friends at Scrabble. Nobody had had the balls to stand up to her and say, Joan, that word doesn't exist.
And she was 4 foot nothing. I used to tease her and say she looked like Jimmy Cranky. He used to drive her mad. And she had grey short hair. She always had a beautiful silk scarf. And she had really sparkly eyes.
So on the outside, she looked like an upstanding member of the community with a posh accent and all that. But behind it all, she was a very different person. She was contrary, I would say, and she was devilish. She ate a greasy spoon breakfast every morning. So 84 years of having a greasy spoon breakfast, then she was surprised that her heart went out.
I think a year and a bit after us knowing her, she ended up getting a lump in her leg, and it was getting bigger and bigger, and she was, oh, it'll be fine. And eventually we badgered her enough to go to the doctors. And as you can imagine, it was really hard. You could never tell her anything what to do. So she had this big lump, and it was a cancer, and she had to have it all cut out and radiotherapy. She was amazing. She was so brave. And, you know, when people who have had cancer, they ring the bell when it's all from... She ripped it off the wall, and the matron said, nobody's rung that bell that hard. And Joan kind of looked at her and said, I've got a lot of life to live.
Joan recovered from the cancer, but 18 months later had a stroke. After the stroke, her heart was weak, and she chose to take a palliative approach to her last months. Nigel and Julian cared for her at home with the help of a nurse.
She was still in her own garden a couple of days before she died, you know, and she just took to her bed. We were with her on both sides of her bed, holding her hands, and we were just talking to her. And what I didn't know at that point was when you're dying, your hearing is the last thing to go, your last sense to leave. And so the nurse was saying she can hear you. So we were just talking to her, and Julian was saying how brilliant she was at Scrabble. And what a cheat she was, and how she still held the record because they kept all the scores of all their Scrabble games. And Julian said, you know, it was journeys, the longest word, it was journeys, and you got 131 for it. And me being me and philosophical and psychotherapy and all that. And I says, and you're on a journey now, Joan. And it sounds a bit cheesy, but it doesn't. It was just, you know, you're on that now, Joan, and you don't have to hang about for us. You know, you can go, we're with you, we're holding your hand. And we were just talking, and then she squeezed her hand, started, there was tears, and she kind of lifted up a little bit, took a breath, and off she went.
They organised a wonderful funeral for Joan. Julian wrote the eulogy, Nigel oversaw the refreshments. She had asked her boys to be the executors of her will, and a week after the funeral, they got a letter from her solicitors asking them to come into their offices. At the reading of the will, everything was as they'd expected, except for one thing. They understood that Joan had planned to leave her house and its contents to a local museum, but they were told that in the last 18 months of her life, she had changed her will.
In her will, it says something like, I leave my house and all my artwork and everything in the house to my two soulmates, Nigel and Julian, with a wish to turn it into an art house. And that's all we knew. It went on to say, if you don't want to do it, sell the bloody lot. So, do you know what I mean? But there was no question for us.
Joan leaving her house to us to turn into an art gallery didn't feel any more than her asking me to put a penguin on a plate with a cup of tea. That's what it felt like. It just felt a natural extension of what she'd always asked us slaves to do.
Joan and her husband had bought the house in 1963, and much of the decor was from that time. Flock wallpaper, dated plumbing, old carpets. It took a year to clear and convert the house.
I don't really know what Joan imagined the gallery would be. I assume that she maybe wouldn't have thought what we'd done with it. So what we ended up doing is stripping the building back to its original frame and rebuilding it as it would have been in its industrial history. So when it was a factory in 1808, when it was built, we turned it back into that.
They named the gallery the Weaver's Factory. It opened its doors last year.
So I suppose the kind of artists that we have here and what's important to us about the project, I suppose the first thing is legacy, because we've been entrusted with the building, but also Joan's archive. So one of the priorities for me is to make her famous, more famous than what she already is. But the artists that we show here are people who is art, firstly, that we love, that we'd have in our house. Secondly, we've got to really like them as humans. And thirdly, it's affordable.
You know, most galleries are really uptight, and they're that whole thing. I know it's a cliche, but you walk into a gallery, and there's always a woman there with a black turtleneck, and she's on a laptop, and she says, oh, hello. Please feel free to look around. And you don't want to look around at all. So I said, Nigel, let's make it the opposite. Let's make it so you want to come in, never want to
starting
leave.
Starting our commute to work now. I'm locking our front door and we're walking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 steps to the gallery door, and we're going in. So, we're in the gallery shop.
Yeah, I suppose loving Joan is really powerful, or has been a powerful thing in our lives. Running an art gallery is a dream for lots of people who are in the arts and who are artistic and creative. But every time I walk in, whether it's through the garden entrance or the shop entrance, I just see Joan's house. I see it through a veil. I see all her paintings of that she'd collected. I see her furniture, her plants. I see her kitchen. I see where the kettle is, even though, you know, there's now a fire board in the shop. But that's where her kettle is, and that's what I see. You know, I see it all through a veil. So it was really powerful, you know, the impact she's had on our lives.
Julian Bovis and Nigel Durkin, owners of the Weavers Factory, remembering their friend, Joan Charnley. I love that story for a few reasons. Julian and Nigel, the care with which they've converted the house into a gallery, and the sense that I get of their relationship, I just love them, and the gallery giving space and support to other artists. But there's also something special about Joan's life becoming a piece of the tangible history of the building, along with the Weavers. It's beautiful.